see a ghost, but Lord, I'm still not sure what I stand for. What do I stand for? What do I stand for? Most nights I don't know anymore. Amazing things that can come from some terrible
stand for. We're going to be talking about our congregations facing a little bit of existential crisis today and tomorrow. But before we start that, I want to show you my very favorite cartoon of all time. And that is about somebody who stepped out in faith and knew what they stood for. Cliff, can you hit that?
The Exodus. The Israelites are finally free, struggling to leave Egypt behind. But now they find themselves trapped, They arrive at the Sea of Reeds, impossible to cross, and the Egyptian army is thundering down on them from behind. The Israelites cry out to Moses, "Why have you brought us out here to die?" They've been through so much, we can understand their terror. And Moses is their leader, but he doesn't tell them what to do. He just says, "Have no fear. God will rescue you. God will battle for you." Now, God is not so thrilled with Moses' words. God asks, "Why are you crying out to me? Tell the Israelites to march forward. Lift your staff. Part the waters." What a strange moment. The Torah is a bit sparse here about what happened, play by play. So what actually happened? Did the people walk and then the water split? Or is it vice versa? Now, Midrash is a special kind of story that rabbis tell to fill the gaps in Torah. The ancient rabbis created a great Midrash about this moment. They find this character elsewhere in the Torah, named Nachshon. He's Aaron's brother-in-law, which makes him Moses' brother-in-law or something. Anyways, he's also the prince of the tribe of Judah, a leader. According to the Midrash, Nachshon wastes no time. He sees the people crying, observes the other tribal leaders hemming and hawing, hears Moses and God arguing, and he starts to walk into the water, up to his knees, and then his waist, and then his shoulders, and then his neck. The Israelites stop crying. Moses and God stop debating. Seeing Nachshon's courageous march into the churning waves, Moses lifts his staff. Nachshon is now in so deep that he cannot breathe as the water covers his mouth and nose. And then, and only then, the legend goes, the waters began to part. Following Nachshon's courageous example, the Israelites run towards the parting waters, escape to the other side, and join Nachshon on dry land. And then, as we know from the Torah, Pharaoh's army races into the parted waters, only to drown as they come crashing back around them. The ancient rabbis were trying to teach us something by embellishing this scene in the Torah's Exodus story. Moses was a great leader, but even great leaders sometimes get stuck. Sometimes they're busy ruminating, talking, and praying when they need to act. To act with courage and audacity so people know what to do. Nachshon never spoke, but he knew how to act. Now the ancient rabbis added another great teaching. Some of them said, actually, it was only when every Israelite, every woman, man, and child, only then when they all followed Nachshon into the waters, when all of them joined hands in courage and faith, that it was then that the seas parted. And so they're telling us, we can't just wait for a hero to save us. Each and every one of us has the power to step up and lead.
We are the ones we've been waiting for. We are the ones. And I love that part about the legend where it was only after everybody got their act together, joined hands, and got wet that the waters parted. Now, we're going to be talking about some of the further issues that we're dealing with, the driving forces that are shaping our religious life. Today, we're looking specifically at ethnic and religious diversity, and then some with the overall decline in church participation. Tomorrow, we're going to be looking at how people meet this challenge, how they step up, how they get wet, get in the water, and address the challenges meeting us. But today, we're going to be setting a few more of the challenges before us. And there's a whole bunch of little short videos today and tomorrow. Now, first off, I want to say I've gotten some wonderful people asking me for various videos and stories and this film and blah, blah. So I have put a sign-up sheet, or a little sheet, way in the back on a table that has a space for you to write down your email address and what you might like so that I can, like, organize it and remember it, okay? So just write down there, back there, what you might like. Even if it's all of the slides, I can do that too. Okay. So, diversity. Now, sure, we live, and we know we live, in a growing diversity of religious traditions and spiritual alternatives. We know that in this kind of diversity, no single authority exercises any kind of supremacy. No single belief, no single ideology dominates our society anymore. There's a tapestry, a quilt of religious and spiritual alternatives and choices, and people are going across religious boundaries right and left all the time. The whole United States is projected to become a majority of minorities by the year 2043, and that's not that long away. White people will no longer make up a majority of Americans in about 29 years, according to census projections. And that's part of a really historic shift that already is shaping our nation's schools, our younger generations, shaping our workforce, shaping our electorate, and redefining some long-held notions around ethnicity. It's also reshaping, of course, the American religious scene. America continues to grow and become more diverse ethnically. Now, that's partially due to higher birth rates among some minority groups, particularly Hispanics and Asians who entered the U.S. at the height of our immigration move back in the 1990s and early 2000s. And it's partially from current immigration. It's partially from the growth of mixed ethnic families. I mean, just all kinds of reasons for this. But minority children will be the majority in the entire United States by 2019. And that's only 4 years from now. Minority children are now the majority in 10 states. California, Nevada, New Mexico, Arizona, Texas, Florida, okay, you expect that, Georgia, Hawaii, Mississippi, and Maryland. Already, minority children are the majority. And for the first time, America's racial and ethnic minorities now make up about half of the under 5 years old population. It's a historic shift that shows how young people will be and already are at the forefront of sweeping changes around American ethnicity. Millennials, our young adults, are already the most racially diverse generation ever in American history, and a trend that was driven by a large wave of immigrants who came to the United States in the past 50 years. And these people are now having children, and these children are now millennials. 43% of millennial adults are non-white, which is the highest share of any generation. And research shows that millennials are particularly keyed into this, and they will not participate in any institution, including the church, that does not openly and proactively welcome all ethnicities and all colors. Now, this kind of growing change can be raising some anxiety among, even some fear, among some of the people and institutions and groups that have not had to deal with real ethnic differences in any serious way before this. In these next couple of videos, I want to look at some of these questions around the diversity in ethnicity in the United States. Now, the first video is an ad for a book, okay, fine, but I want you to look at the two kids involved there and their reactions on the different days that are depicted in the video. And the second video is a couple of minutes from the Chris Rock show about 2.5 years ago, where he went down to South Carolina and asked people what they felt about the Confederate flag at the State House. Okay, we won't go into all of that, but I want you to look again at the reactions that he was getting.
Yeah. I think it is one of the tragedies of our nation, one of the shameful tragedies, at 11 o'clock on Sunday morning. It's one of the most segregated hours, not the most segregated hours, in Christian America. One of the most segregated hours, if not the most segregated hours, in Christian America.
As I live, when trouble rides, Lord.
Now this summer, the NAACP called for a boycott of South Carolina because the state still flies the Confederate flag over its Capitol dome. Now, the flag has been a very controversial and divisive issue. So we, the people here at the Chris Rock Show, went down to South Carolina, the heart of Dixie, to talk to the folks and see what we could do to straighten out this whole mess. How do you feel about the Confederate flag hanging over the state capitol?
I feel like it ought to stay up forever. Forever.
It's part of our heritage, and I wish people would just let it alone.
I think it's cool.
It's a symbol of family and of pride. It's a symbol of...
Of family and pride?
Yeah.
To me, it's like the bat flag. And it's like, oh, we got to kick a black guy's ass. Let's set up the cracker signal. That's what it looks like to me.
I'd say it's up there for one reason.
And what's the reason?
The reason is that we're Southerners, and that's why it's up there.
Now, what's the best thing about South Carolina white people?
Well, sometimes, you know what I'm saying, I like the way when white ladies be wearing their shorts and stuff, but it's all great, you know what I'm saying?
What have you done to get it taken down?
I've written my Senator Strom Thurmond.
Right.
And I think the federal...
Didn't he used to own slaves?
Yes, he did.
Okay. Do you think the police would mess with you if you went to the top of the state house and ripped down a Confederate flag?
Oh, yeah. I think they're going to handcuff me up. They'll probably take me to some woods and beat me up for doing it.
You think Al Sharpton should come down here and just straighten this whole mess out?
Who? I'm sorry.
Al Sharpton?
I'm sorry, I don't know who he is. You're making me look stupid.
No. He's like Martin Luther King with a perm. You think black people would feel better if they got to put up their own flag?
No, I don't.
We devise some flags.
Okay, we can see the rest this afternoon, but he goes into some alternative flags, one of which is Malcolm X, and gets their reactions. But you could see the reactions of people. You could see how these two kids on Friday and Saturday working together in school, playing together on the weekend, and then boom, Sunday, they're divided. And that was not making them happy. So these are questions that we still are wrestling with as our culture, as our whole society increases in its diversity. Now moving on, the growth in U.S. cultural and ethnic diversity directly affects our religious outlook. And the increase of people with new and alternative religious traditions contributes to our ability to move back and forth across religious boundaries and make new religious choices. In many ways, we've become a nation of religious nomads, tinkerers and nomads. 44% of all adults now have either switched their religious affiliation at least once, or twice, or three times or more, and move from being unaffiliated with any religion to be affiliated with a particular one, or dropped any connection and become unaffiliated, or back and forth. It's quite a churn. Another one of my favorite little cartoons, you probably can't read it, so let me do so. Our friend the bear, the preacher, says, "Let us give praise, for ours is the one true faith." And then the little rabbit pops up and says, "Well, pardon me, but the very essence of faith is a belief in the existence of something that can't be proven. So naturally, everyone believes that their faith is the one true faith." This means that all faiths are equally valid, giving no one the right to claim any religious authority. So, or superiority. So let's just practice our faith in the time-honored tradition of religious tolerance, says the rabbit. Well, the rabbit, as you see at the end, disappears. I know a few of my ministerial colleagues who would like to nibble on a few rabbits in their congregation, but we don't do that. Not quite. But tolerance, the time-honored practice of tolerance, people are needing to learn that in new ways now. Another Pew survey from 2014 documents how immigration is contributing to this diversity in the American religious quilt. For example, Muslims, roughly two-thirds of whom are immigrants, the other third are many of them are multiple generational black Muslims, but two-thirds of them are about immigrants. But they still roughly account for about 0.7% of the American population. A little over half and under 1%. And Hindus, more than 8 in 10 of whom are foreign-born at this point, now account for approximately 0.5% of the population. Buddhists are 1%. And the Pew found that Jews account for 2%. These are large numbers. The percentages seem small, but they're large numbers. So what is it about American society that enables us actually to be accepting about multiple religious traditions, even though we are still wrestling with some issues around ethnicity? While the U.S. is not as religiously diverse as places like Singapore or Taiwan or even France, for that matter, which has 8% Muslim and 28% unaffiliated, still, our religious diversity has been growing in recent years. I'm going to share a little PBS video right now that's an interview with Dr. Robert Putnam. He's one of the authors of the book American Grace, and he looks at a number of historical and social factors that are contributing to the growth of American religious diversity and our openness to this, and he calls it the Aunt Susan factor.
For the past 6 years, Harvard public policy professor Robert Putnam, along with Notre Dame's David Campbell, has been studying religion in America. The result is American Grace. 3,000 Americans interviewed twice, congregations visited, conclusions drawn, many of them surprising. We met up with Putnam at a Quaker meeting house near his home and office in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Bob Putnam, welcome.
Thanks, Paul.
For you, what were the major discoveries, the ahas?
Well, there were a couple. The first is that America is a very religious country, and we were able to show that that religion, in some respects, has highly favorable effects for American democracy. On the other hand, if you look across the whole world, you can see that religion taken in high doses is toxic. Most places in the world that are devout and diverse also have a high index of mayhem. Bosnia or Beirut or Belfast or Bombay. How can we be both religious and diverse and also tolerant?
So what's the answer?
Aunt Susan.
Aunt Susan.
All Americans have an Aunt Susan. Aunt Susan is someone you know in your extended family. She's Jewish and you're Baptist, or she's Methodist and you're Catholic, or she's nun and you're, you know, Mormon or whatever. And you know that your faith says, sadly, Aunt Susan's not going to heaven because she's not in the right religion. But come on, it's Aunt Susan. You know that if anybody's going to heaven, it's Aunt Susan. She's made for heaven. So all Americans are caught in this dilemma that we know what we say on Sunday morning. You know, I'm the way, the truth, and light. My way or the highway. But we know Aunt Susan.
But there are no Aunt Susans in Bosnia, Beirut, Belfast, Bombay?
No, actually, not many. The intermarriage rate, for example, between Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland is roughly 8 to 10%. That is roughly 8 to 10. In the United States, it's 50%. So we're much, much more likely to be married to people and who are in a different faith.
How much more religious are people here in America than people in other countries which have achieved the same economic level of development?
We're way more religious than most other advanced countries. The average level of church attendance in the United States, for example, is a little bit of controversy, but it's probably about 30 or 40% a week, roughly something like that. In England, it's 5%. We're Americans, the average American is more religiously observant, and its religion is more important in their life than for the average Iranian. So we are, America is a more religious country. I don't mean we're a theocracy, but we're a more religious country at the grassroots level than many, many, even countries that look like they're pretty devout, like Iran.
And why?
I think the most common explanation is, in a way, our religious diversity. That is, right from the founding of America, we've had no church, no official state church. That's why the Pilgrims came here. All sorts of religions have flourished here in this country because there's not a state monopoly of religion. And there, Americans have been incredibly inventive in religious terms. We've invented more religions, actually, in the last 200 years than any place else in the world. Mormonism, for example. Some of them have flourished, as Mormonism has.
And we were so religiously tolerant. Why?
Well, initially we were tolerant because we had to be. There were so many different religions here on this continent that no one religion was powerful enough to impose itself on everything else. But what's happened, as I say, in the most recent 50-year period is we've actually begun to live with one another, to sleep with one another, to love one another across religious lines. It's not airy-fairy kind of, you know, let's be warm hands and be tolerant. It's that, you know, I know Aunt Susan. And it becomes very hard to demonize someone or demonize a whole religion if you know people in it. And in our research, actually, from a scientific point of view, because we interviewed people twice, we could watch them change, and we could watch people who didn't initially look so tolerant get a new friend who was Mormon or who was Jewish or who was evangelical. And we can see their attitudes soften, not only toward that religion, the religion of their new friend, but towards all religions.
So that's the good news. Is there bad news?
Yeah.
Also, this afternoon, I've got a little video that talks about racism being alive and well in good old Southern Christian churches. That's the title of it, not my title. And it's an author who describes how he escaped becoming like Dylann Roof, who perpetrated the shootings in Charleston. And he describes how his society, his entire structure of his growing up led to the same kind of beliefs that Dylann Roof seems to have. So we'll work with that one and probably look at the bad news that Robert Putnam was talking about. The next couple videos I want to show you, actually, one of them I'm going to shift to the afternoon, and it's about two Muslim comedians on the road. Allah Made Me Funny is the name of their comedy tour. And they say some very pointed and interesting things about relationships among religious people and how they are treated as obvious adherents of Muslim, of the Islam religion. And then I've got a video right now that I'm going to show you, and it's just a few minutes of some women, and they're talking about their conversion to Islam and what that's meant to them.
After the Boston bombing, much of the speculation and stereotyping around Islam and American Muslims has been directed towards Catherine Russell, the American widow of the now deceased Tamerlan Tsarnaev. Now, media reports have suggested that Russell, who converted to Islam, was coerced and controlled by her husband, an all-American girl brainwashed by her fanatic husband, if you will. Now, these misconceptions about Muslim women in America aren't unique to Russell. American women who convert to Islam are often similarly misjudged and misunderstood, and the scrutiny has only heightened following the bombings. Some of those women are now here with us to share their decisions and experiences firsthand.
And there are plenty, so many Muslim women who, if we're just restricting our comments to dress, do not choose to wear the hijab.
Yes.
Whether or not, like, honestly, choosing to wear the hijab makes your life more difficult. It's a way in which you experience more prejudice.
Based on a desire, if you will, to please God and only God, he should be foremost in your life. And really, I started wearing the hijab before I even made my shahada and decided to become Muslim. For me, I come from a background where, unfortunately, I was abused early on in my life. And for me, the hijab was a way, it gave me my self-confidence back. It gave me my self-worth back. I felt like this big weight had been lifted off of my shoulders, and all of a sudden, I felt like I was being seen through new eyes by people. I had so much more respect from people. The difference that it makes on how you're treated, people look at you and they see you as a person.
Right.
And not as, you know, a woman who's on a commercial trying to sell a car dressed
but
in skimpy clothing.
I actually think that people look at me and they see a stereotype. Like, I still feel that people look at me and they see my scarf and they make certain assumptions about me that are just as inconvenient as if I didn't wear
Lizzie,
it. I don't
feel like
my authentic self is more seen.
I was raised in the Congregationalist tradition, Ahmed, which is a pretty liberal Protestant tradition, maybe like one step to the right of Unitarianism. So I wasn't raised in a very Trinitarian church to begin with. And when I started to learn, I mean, look, you know, you mentioned earlier that my brother converted before I did, and I learned most of my Islam from him, but there were 7 years in between when he converted and when I converted. So I spent a long time thinking about this and asking questions.
And what was it, though? But what were those answers that Terry referred to that brought you solace or brought you comfort or brought you whatever it is that makes you a Muslim? Joy, peace, modesty?
So I think what I wanted for myself was a more intimate and visceral relationship with God than what I felt my home church offered me. You know, I loved the way Muslims prayed. I loved that they prayed with their bodies. I loved that they prayed multiple times a day. I didn't feel like I was getting the spiritual food that I needed by just going to church once a week. Although there are many lovely things about church, and there are a lot of things that I miss about it now.
Right.
It's just very different. And so for me, you know, I really wanted what I felt like, you know, was like a direct line to God all the time. And I felt like Islam offered that, and I felt like the theology was just beautiful.
I'm hoping that we'll have some good discussion about the things that she just said, about why her conversion. I mean, two millennial young adult women, and I think that their testimonies really defy some of the stereotypes that we have around women who wear the hijab and convert to Islam. Now, during the last few decades, there has been also, in the midst of this growing diversity in ethnicity and diversity in religious traditions, there's also been a decline in participation in most faith traditions. Not just membership, we've been looking a lot at membership, but participation on Sunday morning and in volunteer activities and on committees and on pledging and things that members usually do. And once again, it affects all faith traditions. All faith traditions, and Christian, evangelical, UU, et cetera, et cetera. This has been found, of course, in Unitarian Universalism. Note the headlines on this little slide here. They come from the UU world. Membership growth slows. UUA membership declines. UUA membership declines again. Yet Pew was reporting, of course, that more people identify as Unitarian Universalist. Once again, though, it's not showing up in the congregations. And many faith traditions are also finding that there are fewer and fewer young Americans that want to join in the parish clergy. Ministers are aging as a group right now, and there are fewer young clergy coming up to take their place when the older ones retire. Unitarian Universalists are facing something similar in that we have a whole group of folk that are about ready to retire, and we have a whole bunch of people coming through seminary, but most of them are going into community ministry rather than parish. So that's one of those other things that I think we'll talk about today, because nobody really knows exactly why that's happening yet. But we're also facing a decline in the numbers of new people coming into parish ministry. Now, why are some of the reasons for this decline in actual participation? Mark Chavez, in a book called American Religion, says that part of the reason is that Americans have lost respect for religious leaders, which may also say why some people don't want to go into parish ministry. Why do you go into a profession where people don't respect you? His research shows a marked decline in overall trust in religious leaders. Less than 25% of Americans say they have great confidence in their clergy. Ouch. Chavez also notes that Americans increasingly disapprove of religious leaders getting involved in politics, especially right-wing politics, and we know that people paint all clergy, just like they paint all faith traditions, with the same brush. There's also a couple of researchers, Fraser and Bader, in the book called America's Four Gods. They argue that part of the decline in church attendance and the rise of the nuns is traced back to dissatisfaction with dominant American concepts of God, that God is too authoritarian, too distant. They actually find there are four concepts of God in American religion: the authoritarian God, who is wrathful and sin-hating, the distant God, cosmic creative force behind the universe, the benevolent, forgiving, healing, peacemaker God, and the critical bringer of justice who makes things right. So they believe that the emphasis, however, on that authoritarian God, the big one there, the top one, is what's also driving a lack of participation, even among some members or some affiliated folk in congregations. They just can't jive that. Their theology, what they're told with a dominant concept of God, they can't jive that with how they feel and what they experience. Some church researchers believe that even though people may be rejecting organized faith traditions, the institutional church, and religious leaders, they're still yearning for more spirituality in their lives, something they're not finding in their current congregations, just like the young woman raised Congregationalist turned to Islam to find that. I want to just remind you that the sociologist Christian Smith observed that liberalism did win a decisive, larger cultural victory, he says, but that cultural victory did not happen because more people joined liberal churches. He said it's because the liberal values became more culturally dominant. But that cultural victory really is not helping us on Sunday morning. That's not helping us on Sunday morning. So this next video I have is called Why Nobody Wants to Go to Church. And I'm going to see if I can show you at least a couple of minutes of this one before we get into the next video.
Well, Tom, I want to welcome you. For those that don't know Tom Schultz, he's the founder and CEO of Group Publishing. And several years ago, I had the privilege of publishing several books with Group. And so, Tom, it's an honor to have you with us today.
That's great to be with you. Thank you.
So, in addition to running Group Publishing, you are an author yourself, and today I wanted to visit because one of your book titles has caught my attention because it reflects on an area of passion that I have, and that's helping churches that are stuck. The title of your book is called Why Nobody Wants to Go to Church Anymore, and first of all, I'm just curious, what prompted you to write the book?
Yeah, well, here at Group, we've been following and serving the church for 40 years now. And over that time, we've seen a lot of good things happen. And we've also seen some things that are challenging, particularly in the last 10 years or so. We've seen how the people who we deal with day in and day out, church leaders and church members, congregations, how they are struggling more and more. And we wanted to dig into that, find out why, and also take a look at, well, what might be some of the answers for us moving forward.
Well, in fact, in your book, you indicate that you found that 80% of the churches are stuck. How did you uncover that?
Yeah, that's research that others have done, actually, that have found that 80%, some say 85% of churches are stuck or in decline. And anecdotally, we hear evidence of that every day from churches who call in and talk with our people here who are experiencing that phenomenon of being stuck or in decline.
Well, with so many churches being stuck, I think what tends to grab our attention is the stories from the churches that are growing, especially large churches seeing year over year growth. How do you account for that happening and yet us finding ourselves in the situation with many churches are just trying to survive to keep their doors open?
Yeah, it's true that large churches, at least many of them, are growing, and the number of large churches is slowly growing. And also, we're seeing some growth in very small churches, churches under 100. Now, what we have to keep in mind, though, is with all of those individual statistics, what's happening on the broad scene overall. And overall, attendance and participation and spiritual vitality continue to go down. So that tells us, when we sum total that up, that what's happening by and large with the large churches that we're hearing the good news out of is that it's more a factor of consolidation. With small and medium-sized churches closing, those people are fleeing and finding themselves a home in the larger churches, which are showing growth.
So based on your understanding of what's happening in the church, why would you say the majority of churches are stuck?
It's a number of reasons. Some of them are cultural. What's happening in our culture today of where people are finding their information and their spiritual nourishment elsewhere other than the church. And it's what's happening on the inside, where churches are simply not connecting with people today. And we've identified a number of factors that the people have told us as to why they're avoiding church today.
Interesting. So you've done a lot of research, particularly around the people's general attitude towards church, those outside the church, how they view the church. What most surprised you in that research?
Yeah, we identified several things that they mentioned, and some of them were really expected and things that we've heard before, like people in church are hypocrites. We've heard that for forever. But one that jumped out at us that we heard loud and clear, particularly from certain segments in the non-church population, is this, that I don't want to be lectured, that they view church as a vehicle of one-way communication where they're expected simply to come in and sit passively while somebody, the pastor, the leader, the teacher, does all the talking. And people today want to participate. They want to be a part of the conversation. It probably comes out of the emphasis and influence of things like the internet, where people have the opportunity to interact with the communication.
So with things like that in mind,
But yes, they go on and talk about it, and it's actually a great book, Why People Don't Want to Go to Church Anymore, or Why Nobody Wants to Go to Church Anymore. And I recommend that. It's on the bibliography, which I can give you. I want to end with a case study today. And this is where we start getting into the existential stuff. Now, we know that a lot of people, millennials, young adults, are comfortable with change. But we have to question whether our congregations are comfortable with change. So this case study I want to look at is the story of Kodak. Now, we all know that Kodak was once the name in photography. Kodak dominated the photographic scene for more than 100 years. It commanded an 89% market share of photographic film sales in the United States, and everybody used it. We know as a social meme the phrase, a Kodak moment, right? But Kodak plants have been downsizing and closing ever since the advent of digital photography. It's a colossal story of failure and misjudgment. It's a gigantic casualty in the wake of digital photography. And actually, it was Kodak that invented digital photography. Back in 1975, one of their engineers did it. And this engineer said, but it was filmless photography, so management's reaction was, well, that's cute, but we don't need that. We don't need that. And so then the company entered into decades of decline, and it was unable to perceive and respond to that advancing digital revolution. In 2012, it filed for bankruptcy. So how could this happen? Where did the leaders go wrong in this? And are there parallels between Kodak and what's happening in our congregations? I have a 3-minute video.
When you hear Kodak, what's the first thing you think of? Unless you're really young, it's probably photography. Specifically, film photography. For over 100 years, Kodak absolutely dominated the film industry. There was no one else. They had 89% market share, and their name was synonymous with photographic film. For most of my life, and probably most of my parents' lives, everyone in the world wanted to have a Kodak moment. Over the last 20 years, the Kodak story has changed. Kodak decided not to embrace the digital camera revolution. And in January of 2012, they had to file for bankruptcy protection. It's hard to imagine that a company that was so dominant for so long could fail so quickly. But it gets even crazier. The guy who invented the digital camera, Steve Sasson, actually worked for Kodak. Seriously, a Kodak employee invented the first digital camera. But when he brought it to his superiors, they told him it was cute, but not to talk about it. They feared that it might threaten Kodak's film market. And the rest is history. Today, it's almost impossible to find camera film anywhere. Virtually every camera sold is digital, and almost none of those are Kodak cameras. Kodak hung on to their traditional methodology in the name of protecting what they believe was the core of their very successful company. But despite their reluctance, the culture kept moving on, and Kodak got left behind. Church people are stubborn. We hang on to our methods and become very protective of them. We're very, very reluctant to change. I think that stubbornness comes from a lot of places. One of those is fear. We fear losing members. We fear what it might mean for us if our church changes. And most of all, we fear losing what we have. These fears keep us clinging to what has worked in the past. They prevent us from facing the future and the changes that are already at work in the culture around us. Which isn't to say that we don't change at all. It's just that we do so real slowly. Remember Bill Hybels and Willow Creek back in the 70s and 80s? I mean, it was scandalous church. It was scary for people. We took the organ out of church and brought in these funky instruments, and we brought in comfortable seats and new lighting and a stage instead of a platform. And you know, we even had drama in church. I mean, this was a whole new crazy model of church. But now, that model has become our new sacred cow. Our mega churches make us feel successful, but the church's influence and attendance continues to decline. I love this verse from 1 Chronicles. It's part of a description of David's growing army. From the tribe of Issachar, 200 leaders who understood the times and knew what Israel should do. Maybe the church is just missing its tribe of Issachar. Or maybe those leaders are already here and we're ignoring them. Maybe we've told them, just like Kodak told Steve Sasson, to go back to their work and keep their cute little ideas to themselves. Kodak failed because its leaders squandered a golden opportunity to move into a new era with a radical idea, filmless photography. Instead, they radically defended the status quo. I don't want the church to fail for the same reason. I don't want to see us stubbornly defend our current methods just because they're our current methods. I want to see us take some risks, step out in faith, and see what God can do. So that's our challenge, and I'm turning to you for help.
And then he goes on to talk about what their congregation's going to be doing to step out in faith in new ways. I mean, we did learn some things from Kodak. We did learn some things. We learned that they misunderstood their mission. They thought of themselves as being in the film business, but it was being in the image creation business. They know that they had a failure to read the times. They couldn't see that digital photography was really going to be taking over the market. And they had a fear of loss. Loss of what they knew, loss of the familiar, loss of the market that they had some control over, and felt that they were the ones that controlled it. How do we avoid becoming Kodak? That's going to be a question for this afternoon. There's a couple of things that we'll talk about, how we accept and understand reality and know what's going on so we can address it, how we don't just tweak what we've got now, but how we revolutionize it so that we're not stuck thinking that we're in the film business when we really need to be thinking about the image creation business. And then we're going to talk about risks, experiment, and how we can act now. I mean, the question is, what do we stand for? We started with that song today. How do we step out in faith like Nakshon? And this is what we're going to talk about this afternoon. Thank you.